This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
This advertisement feature is paid and presented by Go Türkiye. Istanbul takes food seriously, very seriously. And meyhane restaurants are where it all comes to life. These traditional establishments are all about community, shared plates, loud conversations, and ruckus served as part of the ritual. But take a small detour and the food starts doing something different. As innovators in the kitchen, like Chef Deniz, continue to rewrite the menu.
In Istanbul, new young chefs like me develop the Turkish cuisine, but we don't replace tradition. We give it new life.
Because in Istanbul, food never stands still.
Old flavors, new ideas.
It evolves. Slowly, confidently, one plate at a time. Plan your next detour at goturkiye.com today.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parris. So, if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
This is the BBC.
Welcome to The Briefing Room from the BBC with me, David Aronovich. This week, I'll be trying to find out if all that furore in the Trump White House actually matters. Gone in less than 900,000 seconds.
The fish stinks from the head down. But I can tell you two fish that don't stink, OK? And that's me and the president.
R.I.P. Anthony the Mooch Scaramucci, July 2017 to July 2017. Whoever replaces the Mooch will be Trump's third communications director. His press secretary has resigned, he's fired his acting attorney general, and he's on his second chief of staff, John Kelly, a retired general who many hope will bring discipline to a leaky White House. Just today, we were treated to transcript of Trump's private phone calls with the President of Mexico and the Prime Minister of Australia. Donald Trump tweeted this week, "A great day at the White House." Others say it's chaos. His second press secretary brushed this off with a homely invitation.
If you want to see chaos, come to my house with three preschoolers. This doesn't hold a candle to that.
By the standards of almost all modern American politics, this seems bizarre, if not catastrophic. But then, by the standards of almost all modern American politics, Donald Trump would not be president. So here in the briefing room, we'll be taking a step back and trying to find out what the actual consequences of the dramas of Trump's West Wing could be. It may be fascinating, but does it actually matter? The BBC's senior correspondent, Johnny Diamond, has been watching attentively as the mound of skulls has grown.
The key to comprehending the White House today is to forget about it being the executive arm of the US government. It is instead closer to a medieval court with rules and rivalry, princes and positioning. So let me draw back the gilded curtain and guide you through the court of King Donald I. The first rule is that King Donald is all-powerful. There is one king, and it is him. The moment you lose his confidence, no matter how excruciatingly embarrassing your dismissal might be in a normal world, you are out. King Donald is absolute and can do no wrong. So marching Anthony Scaramucci, the director of communications, to the dungeons just 10 days after his appointment was just fine. What's the problem?
You know, one of the things I cannot stand about this town is the backstabbing that goes on here, okay? Where I grew up and the neighborhood I'm from, we're front stabbers.
The second rule is loyalty. To question King Donald is to pour hemlock to the brim and raise it to your lips.
And if I'm in a discussion where people have different views, I want to make sure I've got what I need to back up my views.
So when Sally Yates, the acting Attorney General, instructed her staff not to implement King Donald's travel ban, she was gone. And when James Comey, the director of the FBI, says that he refused to swear fealty, he went into the moat to swim with the fishes too.
And although the law required no reason at all to fire an FBI director, the administration then chose to defame me and, more importantly, the FBI.
The third rule is truth-telling. That might sound strange given the stream of fictions that have come from the court of King Donald. But there is a line you do not cross. You don't lie to the king or to his princes. So when the National Security Advisor, Michael Flynn, was revealed to have lied to the vice president, he was food for the falcons. The fourth rule is watch your back. The court is full of factional fighting. You may think you are the chief of staff appointed as gatekeeper to the king after you loyally fought for him when so many dearly wished for an act of God to take him from the earth. But you can be removed in an instant when you fall from grace, as was Reince Priebus, dismissed with barely a second glance as King Donald's favour fell elsewhere.
I'm always going to be a Trump fan. I'm on Team Trump.
The fifth rule, never, ever embarrass King Donald. Like many monarchs, King Donald is thin-skinned and can't take much of that. Every court needs a jester, a fool, even a piñata. And Sean Spicy Spicer, the White House spokesman, was that man.
With Bashar al-Assad in charge.
Bashar al-Assad, I know you've mispronounced his name a few times.
But there's a limit, pal. And when Spicy proved an embarrassment, the executioner was called.
Don't make me make the podium move.
So long, Spicy, and thanks for all the belly laughs.
If the president puts Russian salad dressing on his salad tonight, somehow that's a Russian connection.
There's more, of course, so much more. Don't cross the family. Don't even think of outshining the king, not for even one news cycle. But most of all, courtiers should remember the French king, Louis XIV. L'État, c'est moi, he said. The state, it's me. Today's wild ride of hirings and firings at the White House isn't about policy or ideology, isn't constrained by precedent or etiquette. It's about King Donald. Believe in him, flatter him, burnish his image, and you may yet survive. For a while, at any rate.
Ye olde Johnny Diamond. Tonight, the president is preparing for a rally in the Rust Belt state of West Virginia. The people of the state turned out to support him last November. What do Trump supporters make of the ongoing White House drama? Adam Gingrich worked for Donald Trump's campaign in Pennsylvania, another Rust Belt state which voted Republican last year, just for the first time since 1992.
We're largely unamused by the palace intrigue that we are running into. Our media has really gone into almost a fanatical, it's a tabloid mentality now, that they're just really isolating people in the White House and making their personalities larger than what they really should be as far as a policy discussion. So it's somewhat frustrating for us. Typically, if you're talking about the president's agenda, and we end up talking about what his son-in-law might have said, or the leaks, as you know, are kind of ridiculous over here. The leaks tend to guide the conversation.
So you blame the media a bit, but presumably also you blame the people who are giving them the stories upon which they're basing this palace intrigue discussion.
Absolutely. I think it's a self-fulfilling cycle here. I think we have people that the media are just in a frenzy to keep the story going. And it's successful for them. Their numbers are up. Their circulation numbers are up. Their website paywalls are starting to pay off for them, so to speak. And as long as that need is there, that hunger on the media side, I think we're going to continue to find people in the administration way down the lower, you know, rungs of the ladder that are going to be willing to feed this hunger for leaks.
What do you think that has got to be done about it inside the White House itself?
Well, I think we've run through the gamut of what doesn't work. So we're looking now at the enforcement and discipline of General Kelly. I mean, this is a wartime general, a Marine. He is a war hero. He's the highest ranking officer to ever lose a son in battle in Afghanistan. And he's going to lay down a military-like chain of discipline. If General Kelly cannot stop the leaks, then I fear that we're going to have to live with their existence.
Why do you think these leaks are happening? Why do you think they're doing it?
Well, I mean, obviously, there's a Republican revolt internally since Trump came down the escalator two years ago and announced he was running. For us, it's an internal battle that probably confuses people on a global scale because they're probably wondering why the party system isn't functioning like it normally does.
Do you think it's got in the way of getting things done?
Oh, that's absolute. I believe that's empirical rather than anecdotal right there. I think everything we haven't done is testament to the split within the Republican Party. That Congress is just absolutely recalcitrant. They're just being as difficult as they possibly can. And I think that they, going into next year, we have a midterm election. What we don't get done, the American public will be in no mood to reward the Republican congressman. They better wake up because I want to make it clear that 8 out of 10, a solid 8 out of 10 Republicans back the president. So they have nowhere to go in a midterm election if they're going to try to run against the president's interest. They're going to get unelected.
So you think that Trump could win where the Republicans would fail?
Absolutely. I think he's kind of transcended political, traditional political interest, and that upsets the apple cart when you have a two-party system like this. Obviously, he and President Macron are two very different people, but they are also two people that came without a traditional political structure and to become the executive of the country. So it's an interesting parallel there between Macron and Trump. Although Macron has more experience in government on the way up, they both did not have a traditional base of political party support.
Okay, let's talk about the people just very briefly now, about the people you represent, in a sense, the people, the voters who supported Donald Trump in states like Pennsylvania. What do you believe they're making of it, and what do you think they will think if this continues?
Right now, they're fine. I mean, obviously, our numbers are a solid 40% across the board in almost every poll. And we go state by state and we see that we're some states like Michigan, he's at 50%. And here, he's a little under 50%. So it's settling. It's settling in a way that is a little, 5 points lower than where Obama settled early on. But hey, we're not up for election as far as Trump's concerned until 2020. You know, what I hear from my followers, my supporters, the frustration with Congress is taking a prominent voice now. And hey, they're going to take out their frustrations in 2018 in the primary process and in the general election. They might just sit home. So we're going to hold Congress responsible.
If Adam Gingrich is any guide, recent events have not done President Trump too much damage yet with supporters. But how does all this palace intrigue affect the way the country is run? Well, here to brief me are two people with a good knowledge of how the White House operates. Joining us from Great Falls in Virginia, Stefan Halper was a foreign policy advisor to Presidents Nixon, Ford and Reagan. He's now Emeritus Senior Fellow of the Center of International Studies. Leslie Vinjamuri is Associate Fellow of the Americas Program at Chatham House, and she's in New York. And also with us in our Washington studio is Anthony Zerka, who is the BBC's North America correspondent and hosts the Trumped podcast on the World Service. Stefan Halper, if I could start with you, we've heard about the unprecedented way that Donald Trump runs the White House. Do you think this leadership style of his matters in practical terms?
Yes, I actually do. I think it matters a great deal because when you do not have predictability in the White House, when the staffs are uncertain about the president's direction or priorities, they're very slow to take a position and to support what may or may not be the policy that's been talked about. What you have in the White House at the moment are multiple power centers, and the president and the White House represent a version of America which is opposed by an entirely different and very large segment of the country. Trump's approval ratings at today are at 33%, not 50%, not 40%, but 33% on the Pew polls. So we all have different versions of what's going on. But the fact is the country's very confused, very frustrated, and angry, actually, at the lack of progress.
I should just explain that Pew is a polling organisation when we talk about Pew polls. Leslie Vindramuri, do you agree with that? Is that your perception too?
Well, I think it's right, but I think it's also important to emphasize that the other thing that's going on here is that there's a basic lack of functionality across the executive branch. There are well over 400 senior appointments that haven't been made. These are subject to Senate confirmation, and these are people that are absolutely crucial if the federal agencies are going to implement law and policy. Now,
sorry to interrupt you. What kind of people are we talking about?
We're talking about deputy assistant secretaries of state, very high-level people that are running parts of the world that the number one in any agency needs to turn to for policy advice, for implementation, for running the bureaucracy. And remember that for a president that's doing a lot of what he's doing through executive order or trying to, he's then working with a number of agencies that simply are understaffed. And if you look at the Secretary of State, right, he has access to money that he's chosen not to spend, that if he doesn't spend it by the end of September, the State Department will simply lose. So there's a lot going on even beyond the White House, across the executive branch, that's making it very difficult for this administration to get anything done.
Stephen Halper, yes, please come in.
But may I support what Leslie said, particularly with reference to the State Department where I served? There are 22 assistant secretaries of state. So far, two of them have been appointed and confirmed. The rest are absent. And the point is that without these people in place and their deputies, you can talk all you want to about the broad outlines of policy, but nothing is going to get done. Nothing will be implemented. Money will not be matched to programs. People will not be sent out into the field.
Anthony Zerka, is it fair to say that nothing's being done? If we look across the Trump policies, what can we see in terms of what has been implemented, what's going through, and what's just stalled?
Well, I think you have to look at two major sections of this, what's being done legislatively and what's being done in a regulatory administrative sort of capacity. Legislatively, Donald Trump's agenda has, by and large, stalled. I mean, just last week we saw his attempts at health care reform that he had backed run into a brick wall in the Senate. Tax reform, immigration reform, these ideas that he's floated, they aren't even out of the starting blocks as far as Congress goes. And legislation is how a president makes a lasting mark that will survive beyond his administration. Now, on the other hand, there are regulatory changes that Donald Trump is making at the administrative level, things that don't require congressional oversight, changes in environmental policy at the Environmental Protection Agency, criminal justice changes in the Justice Department. Also, in foreign relations sphere, he has managed to do some rather significant things, including withdrawing the U.S. from the Trans-Pacific Partnership, pulling the U.S. out of the Paris Agreements, or at least starting the clock
on climate change. Paris Agreements on climate change and the Trans-Pacific Partnership is a trade partnership.
Exactly. So those are definitely accomplishments. Another big mark that he's making is that he's appointing judges to lower courts across the country, federal courts across the country. These are people who will serve for their entire lives or until they retire. They're ones who determine whether laws are valid, constitutional, make judgments about policy, whether they conform to legal strictures, all the way up to a Supreme Court nominee, Neil Gorsuch, who he nominated to fill an open vacancy on the court. So that is going to be a lasting mark, and that will be part of his legacy. But to get back to it, yeah, legislation just isn't there so far.
Okay, so no legislation, but plenty of executive orders. And also this very strange thing, which I simply hadn't realised, which is he's got the capacity, or he's found the capacity, to appoint judges, but not to appoint effectively civil servants. What's that all about?
Well, I think part of it is that he doesn't want to fill some of these spots in the federal government. The idea that you leave them empty, then they can't implement policy, they can't get things done. I mean, it's part of his governing philosophy, or at least a philosophy of some of the people in his administration, that if there's no one there, they can't do anything bad, and the administrative state, in the words of Steve Bannon, an advisor here, will wither on the vine. So getting justices in is a priority for conservatives, but maybe not filling out the administration.
Now, can I just ask Stefan Halper, from your recollections of the White House, presumably there always were personality clashes and there always were members of the family at some level involved. One thinks of Hillary Clinton during the Clinton White House and so on. Is this significantly different in terms of the personality mix and the way in which they affect things?
Well, it may not be significantly different, but it is different. What we have here is the president deeply worried about this relationship with Russia. You have multiple investigations going forward regarding his family and the campaigns linked to Russia. There are two things on the table: the possibility of money, that is to say loans, or there may be compromising tapes of misconduct while he was in Moscow. Whatever it is convulsing the president in the sense that he's distracted, he's unable to focus, and the White House staff is in effect paralyzed. Now, the kids, the two, his daughter and son-in-law, act like jokers in a card deck. They go in and out of the Oval Office. They appear to support or reject specific policies, but actually they're not really policy people. They're business people. So this is somewhat strange. I remember in the Nixon White House, we had the Watergate problem, and the president was similarly distracted by that and the special prosecutor. But we did not have a problem with the children. That wasn't an issue.
Yes, that's okay. Leslie Vinger-Murray, can I just ask you pretty quickly about the impact of this chaos on American foreign policy and America's standing abroad? Do you think it actually matters?
Well, it does matter, but there's two things here. First of all, remember that when the rest of the world looks at America, they don't only look at Donald Trump. What they're also seeing is pushback coming from civil society across the United States. Think about the travel ban, something that Donald Trump implemented by executive order. And within hours, people were on the streets across the country protesting. And frankly, beyond America, people were on the streets across the globe protesting. So a lot of what we're seeing is taking place beyond the White House, beyond Congress, and beyond the executive branch, is a sort of pushback against the travel ban. The Paris, the decision to pull out of Paris, we're seeing all sorts of movement across states, cities, led by Bloomberg, by former Secretary of State John Kerry, to get the United States to still meet the agreement, the targets that were set under the Paris Accord. So the rest of the world is seeing a complexity, I think, that they've always seen out of America, which is, on the one hand, there is this very robust civil society. There are all sorts of good things. And if you look at the Pew data on this, what the numbers show us is that the rest of the world is differentiating between the president, the country, and the people. And the numbers on how the rest of the world see Americans remain very high. But what's coming down rather dramatically is how they view the president and how they view the current government.
Anthony Zerka, can I switch you to this question of the Congress? We heard it mentioned earlier by Adam Gingrich. When we did an earlier program in the Briefing Room series, one of the things that was made clear to us by support of Donald Trump was that he had the chance to really do things because there was a Republican majority in both houses of Congress. How has that helped him?
It hasn't helped him a whole lot at this point because he hasn't been able to get many bills through Congress. And part of the reason is that the Republicans, while they have control of Congress, are divided about what to do. I mean, take health care as an example. They were all about changing Barack Obama's health care reform, Obamacare, repealing it and replacing it with something else. They talked about it and campaigned about it on it for 7 years. Finally, they get all the branches of government. They have control of Congress. They have the presidency. They can get their repeal through. And then it turns out they hadn't really thought about how to do it beyond just tearing it up and then replacing it with something else. That wasn't really a concrete plan. And so they ran into a wall on that. They weren't able to get anything passed. It's going to be a similar difficulty with them on tax reform. They know they want to lower taxes, but exactly how to get there is going to run into a bunch of different constituencies with their own bones to pick. So even, you know, controlling all both Congress and the presidency hasn't delivered for them the sort of power that they thought they would have. And there's no indication so far that anything is going to change. If anything, Donald Trump, by criticizing Congress, by blaming U.S.-Russia relations today, the decline in Russia relations on Congress's sanctions bill, that's not going to make him any friends there. And I think increasingly even Republican members of Congress are starting to think they need to go their own way, and working with the president isn't necessarily the best route to take.
Stephen Halper, you have experience of trying to get of White Houses trying to work with Congress. What do you think of the Trump strategy for dealing with Congress?
I think it's very poor. I mean, I think you have to reach out to the Congress. You have to work with them in their own districts. You've got to go out and assist them, help them in relating to their constituents. And the Trump White House has not done that very well. Another thing that is important to realize here is that the media, which opposes Trump in general, is acting like an opposition political party. It's very, very powerful. And when it connects with the constituents across the country, it positions them to oppose what the administration is trying to do, or often affects them that way, what they're trying to do in Congress. And so Trump not only has a problem with individual congressmen, but he has a problem with the media, which is altering the playing field somewhat.
Leslie Vinger-Murray, one of the things I heard from the Adam Gingrich kind of position was this idea that the Republican Congress would be the people to suffer if there was a split between them and Trump, not Trump himself. And there seemed to be a kind of, I don't know how you would describe it, a kind of strategy which was, we'll scare you into doing what we want, and we think that will work rather than it'll anger you and put you off us.
But it's clearly not working, right? And what we've seen so far is that Donald Trump hasn't been able to make that strategy work, if indeed that is the strategy that he's pursuing. But of course, we're also seeing, you know, I suspect behind closed doors a debate amongst Republicans about what to do. And certainly when it came to the vote over the repeal and replace, a number of...
That was the health care policy.
The health care policy, right? A lot of the people voting know that when they go back home, these are very difficult policies to sell because, for example, I'm repealing Medicaid. Their constituents have depended on the expansion of Medicaid. So they do stand to suffer considerable costs if they stand with the president to push forward the legislative agenda in a way that's not really careful with respect to the details. And ironically, remember that it's this president who says that he stands for the interests of the white working class. And yet, on a number of these key legislative items, the people who stand to take a hit is the white working class.
If I may jump in here just to make a point. A lot of the Republicans in Congress, they weren't early on the Donald Trump bandwagon. They were kind of dragged kicking and screaming onto it when they realized that he was going to win the nomination and that he was their only chance of winning the presidency. And they made effectively a bargain that, well, we will support Donald Trump because if he gets elected, he's going to be able to sign all the laws, all the agenda that we want to pass. He's certainly better than Hillary Clinton, and we can control him. Well, I don't think anyone has ever been able to control Donald Trump, so it was a bit of a miscalculation on that part, and they're starting to come to grips with that.
Can I just ask you all a question about Donald Trump himself, given that he seems to be, he's obviously at the center of this? Is actually getting stuff done in the way we conventionally think about that important to him? Stephen Halper, what's your observation?
Well, I think all presidents look to their own legacy. They all want to be able to point to achievements in legislation, executive orders, positioning the United States internationally. And this president is going to have a hard time claiming achievements in that area.
Sure. So, Leslie Vinger-Murray, what's your view?
I think Donald Trump is not a strategic thinker. He's tactical. He lives in the moment. He's very deeply concerned about his popularity and his own personal financial bottom line. And, of course, remember that we're sitting here in a world where the biggest security threat to the United States comes from North Korea, and this is really on his watch. So I think the president cares a lot about succeeding on the approval, on his approval ratings, and he faces a very, very difficult moment for that.
Well, thank you very much indeed. My summing up on this is it would normally be a disaster that the president would find hard to live with all this, but somehow for Donald Trump it may not be. That's all from the briefing room this week. My thanks to Johnny Diamond, Adam Gingrich, Stefan Halper, Leslie Vinjamuri and Anthony Zerka. We'll be back next Thursday at 8. The Briefing Room was presented by me, David Aronovich, and produced by China Collins and Javier Zapata. Please let us know what you think about this programme or the entire series. You can do that by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider. We look forward to reading your comments.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.